This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, Russia staged an elaborate ceremony to mark the 60th anniversary of the end of the Second World War in Europe. More than 50 world leaders, including President George Bush and German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, gathered near Lenin's tomb in Moscow's Red Square to watch a military parade, a symbolic outpouring of patriotism and pride in the defeat of Nazi Germany. That hard-fought triumph cost what was then the Soviet Union 27 million lives. Virtually every family in Russia was affected. For many Russians, then, Victory Day is an immensely emotional and important national holiday. But for many in neighboring countries, it's a painful reminder of another story: the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe, the annexation of the Baltic states, and decades of oppression that followed. Before visiting Moscow, President Bush stopped in Riga, Latvia, to draw attention to this side of the story. Many in the Baltics want President Putin to acknowledge that the Soviet seizure of their countries was illegal. Thus far, however, Putin has refused to apologize, and in a recent address he said, quote, "The demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century." Today, a look at the complicated legacy of the Second World War in Russia and the other former Soviet republics. If you have questions about the Soviet role in World War II and what happened after VE Day, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Lilia Shevtsova is a senior associate at the Carnegie Moscow Center. She joins us now by phone from her home in Moscow. Welcome. Good to have you on the program again.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you.
You were in the streets near Red Square today. I wonder, how did people react to the ceremonies?
Well, it was really an emotional day. You are right. I went together with my mother, who is a war veteran. But we were allowed to enter the Kremlin Square only after the official festivities were over. And so this occasion, this celebration was a little bit unusual because of this tight screening, metal detectors, and everything else. But it was very touching. It was very touching to see the old people with all their medals on their chests. And it was touching to see, you know, how many people we lost during the last year, because at the meeting that we usually attend with my mother, usually last year we had 100 people representing her army. Today it was only 5 people. During the last year we lost 500,000 of war veterans. So it was a very sad and very emotional story. But on the other hand, yes, well, there was a very interesting experience. A band, American military band, together with British band, playing on the Red Square Stars and Stripes. And then we went very slowly down one of the main streets to the American embassy because I wanted to get a kind of, you know, glimpse of what's happening close to the American embassy. There was a large crowd, and people were cheering, and people were welcoming, you know, the diplomats, and people were singing. So the myth about, you know, Russian anti-American feelings, it's a myth, thank God. So it's a human side of the story, but there is, of course, a political side of the story, because this pompous ceremony resembled very much a political theater with one major actor in the midst of the theater, and it was President Putin, who apparently desperately was trying to use the war veterans and political leaders for one goal, mainly to revamp his own authority and to revamp the traditional state.
And amidst all the symbolism of the Second World War, of course, these were Soviet uniforms, Soviet flags, a Soviet triumph that was being remembered.
Oh, yes, yes. But it's quite natural because, well, it was the celebration of the victory of the Soviet Union in 1945. So it's quite natural, the style. But the essence was pretty worrisome and very troubling, especially Putin's vision of the history and Putin's vision of the present and of the future. And the fact that Putin didn't use this occasion the way President Bush has used is a pity. Because what President Bush said, well, I'm not his fan, but what really American president said was a terrific thing. He, in fact, closed the chapter of the Cold War and, you know, closed the chapter of the Second World War when he said that the victors also are not perfect. And the victors meaning the United States and Great Britain, also traded stability for freedom. Putin could have used this occasion also to make a distinction between the Russian nation, between the people, the society, who were really liberators of the Eastern Europe and Stalinist regime. But he unfortunately failed to do it.
Another distinction of this ceremony today was the presence of the German Chancellor, Gerhard Schroeder, of course, the successor, the new government many years ago. But in Germany, to have the German government present officially there was quite a change, too.
Oh, yes. And German Chancellor visiting the cemetery where German soldiers were buried. It's also a symbolic gesture. He, in his way, has tried to solve this antagonism between the past and present, but he did it graciously. Unfortunately, from the Russian side, still, you know, the Soviet flag, the Soviet myth, and first of all, Joseph Stalin continued to be constantly not in the background, but somewhere on the fore scene. And I'm afraid I had this feeling, you know, walking down the streets, that still the Soviet past and Joseph Stalin are haunting us in present.
I was going to ask that. Are we wrong to conflate the celebration of a great victory with nostalgia for the Soviet Union amongst the Russian people or amongst the Russian leadership?
Well, you put it in a very right way. It seems to me the Russian political elite, post-Soviet elite, which is absolutely unable to live in a new modern world, is the political leader who is being torn between past and present. I am talking about President Putin, who apparently feels uneasy because on the one hand, in his several speeches today, he praised Europe and he declared that Russia wants to be European and Russia is a European country. And on the other hand, this constant image of Stalin everywhere. So unfortunately, he failed to change the image of Russia. And as for Russian population and Russian people, I've got a different image. You know, last week, 68% of Russians said that they consider the United States as a benevolent country. Several months ago, approximately 75% of Russians said that they've got nostalgia of the Soviet Union. But only 15% of those people said that they want to return to the past.
Lilia Shevtsova, thank you very much for staying up this late to speak with us. We appreciate your time.
You're most welcome.
Lilia Shevtsova is a senior associate at the Carnegie Moscow Center, and she joined us from her home in Moscow. To help us better understand the current political climate in Russia and how the country's coming to terms with the legacy of the Second World War, we turn now to Andrew Jack, author of Inside Putin's Russia, former Moscow bureau chief of the Financial Times, and he's with us from the FT's offices in London. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
So why does Putin seem to be so nostalgic for this era of Stalin?
Well, of course, Putin, first and foremost, is one, a product of that old Soviet system, which Lilia and others have talked about. And secondly, he is a politician in a contemporary Russia where many other ordinary Russians are, of course, from that period, and they regard the communist era, and even Stalin himself to some degree, as something of which, if they're not proud, then at least they believe there were some positive aspects to it. And Putin, I think, is therefore, on the one hand, trying to use this ceremony that we've seen today as a way to reach out and become an international leader, but on the other hand, very much to play to his domestic audience, really, and try to form a bridge between the old Soviet Russia and the new Russia of today under his leadership.
Yet that comment that we mentioned at the top of the program, it's been widely quoted the last couple of weeks, that the fall of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century, this can only make people nervous in a lot of places.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're pragmatic about it, it has to be said that the domestic rhetoric, such as this comment about geopolitical collapse, was something that is more aimed at calming and smoothing this very difficult transition period that Russians have lived through over the past 15 years in the post-Soviet period. You know, it's not as though we've seen, in practical terms, internationally, a resurgence of a Cold War, of very aggressive Russian activity abroad and so on. So I think in many ways, it's more a political message for ordinary Russians of trying to consolidate them than it is a real threat to the West.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's take a call from Frank, and Frank's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Hello. I wanted to comment on the pictures of Joseph Stalin all over Moscow. To me, this would be an insult to a lot of people. And Putin, I'm not really that much against, because some of his earlier actions, the positions he took with regards to Yugoslavia and a couple of others, I didn't really find that offensive. But as far as Joseph Stalin goes, I find it very offensive. I had a father born in the United States, lived in fascist Italy for a while when he was a kid, because the folks moved back there and then moved back to the States in the early 30s. And from what my father told me about fascist Italy and from what I heard of Soviet Russia during this period, Soviet Russia sounded much worse than fascist Italy. Stalin was on the same order as Adolf Hitler. You know, I can understand the Russians having a heroic struggle against oppression from the West, you know, but the thing is, why eulogize a man like Joseph Stalin? He's awful. He's as bad as Hitler.
Yeah. Andrew Jack?
Yeah, I mean, there is a huge debate, of course, about whether really communism or fascism was the worst tragedy during the 20th century. Of course, Russians, there's no doubt, were giving their lives in vast quantities, many more than any other of the Allied powers, in the defeat of Hitler. But it has to be said that many, many millions of more Russians and those from the former Soviet space also died thanks to the totalitarian repressions in the gulags. And what's striking and rather depressing, of course, is that not only has that sense of nostalgia for Stalin hung around amongst an older generation, but under Putin you started to see really a kind of an increase again of the symbolism of Stalin, a lot more messages and signs that really are quite worrying.
Frank, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about the legacy of World War II in Russia and the other former Soviet states and its impact on present-day politics amongst the Soviet republics. After the break, we'll look at how the meaning of VE Day has changed for Russians over the years. 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. World leaders gathered in Moscow earlier today to celebrate the defeat of Nazi Germany in Second World War 60 years ago. This hour, a look at how World War II is remembered in Russia and how the politics of that era still shape the balance of power among former Soviet republics. Of course, you're invited to join us. The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is Andrew Jack. He's the author of Inside Putin's Russia, and he joins us now from London. And I wonder, Andrew Jack, what is taught in Russian history classes about Stalin's Russia and the victory in the Second World War?
Well, really, not very much at all. First of all, of course, the Russians don't talk about the Second World War. They talk about the Great Patriotic War. So in many ways, in the same way as the West sees this as first and foremost a victory of Britain and the US and France against Germany, in Russia it's seen, partly rightly, as being a victory first and foremost of Russians. But of course, with an important start date that was very different. If the war started for us in Britain in 1939, for the Russians it began in 1941. And why so? Because Stalin, through the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, essentially had a secret agreement with Hitler to carve up the boundaries of the two nations, which Hitler then disrupted in 1941, triggering Soviet involvement. And I'm sorry to say that when you look through most contemporary children's and adolescent textbooks in Russia today, you find very little mention either of that secret pact or indeed more generally of the more repressive actions of the Soviet regime over the years.
And it was Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union, who did say, denounce the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the names of the foreign ministers who negotiated the agreement that divided Poland and among other things. So far, President Putin has been reluctant to do it. His foreign minister said, look, Gorbachev already did it. It's been done. We don't need to do it again.
Yes, I mean, I think even Gorbachev, incidentally, has always refused to in any way condemn Lenin, although I think most contemporary historians would argue that he himself really set the bloody path that was then continued by Stalin. But certainly Putin has appealed much more to the nostalgia of the Soviet period than Gorbachev had or has more recently. And I think in today's victory celebrations in Moscow, clearly it's a delicate time for Putin to come out and condemn what remains still a very ambiguous period for ordinary Russians. But I think it's regrettable perhaps a few days or weeks or even months ago, he couldn't have, in his own words, come out with some of those similar statements himself.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Karina, and Karina's with us from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I recently just published a memoir of my father's on this very subject. He grew up in Austria, which is now Czechoslovakia, Sudetenland, basically, and what he wrestled with was deciding who he hated more, was Hitler or the Russians, Soviets, when they came in, because he suffered under both of them, and after the war was finally over and they got back to their town, the Soviet Russian, whatever, at that point, came in and rounded up the whole town and put them in a camp that had been built by the Germans to house Russian soldiers, and put the townspeople in this town for months until they shipped them off to various collective farms and other camps in East Germany and various other places that they just ended up getting separated from family members and whatnot. But he had horrible experiences under the Russians, much as under the Nazis.
Andrew Jack, Karina's father, his story is hardly unique. That's the other part of this history that so many in Eastern Europe and the Baltic states are remembering today.
That's right. And not only prisoners of war, but even communist-oriented volunteers who went to the Soviet Union, of course, in the 20s and 30s, very often found themselves in labor camps as a result of Stalin's paranoia towards the West. I was very struck going a few years ago to Auschwitz, and then a few months later to Perm 36, which is pretty much the nearest thing in Russia to a sort of a preserved museum of the Gulag. And it's just very striking. You go to Auschwitz and you see busloads of children every day coming in to remind themselves of the horrors of Nazism. But in this tiny little museum, one of the few that remains standing today with some of the old Gulag buildings, you have perhaps a few hundred volunteers who turn out each year. So there's really nothing like a serious redress and discussion mm-hmm. about that painful period in Russia.
Russian prisoners of war held in German prison camps suffered persecution when they returned to Russia as well, fearful that they were somehow had been politically corrupted.
Yes, it's difficult to understate the degree of paranoia and fear amongst ordinary Russians and amongst anyone who'd been, as it were, seen as tainted by contact with the West and other parts of Europe. And many of them remained in labor camps for months and even years after the end of the war.
Thanks very much for the call, Karina.
Thank you.
I wonder, some people have asked, Germany lost the war. There was denazification. There has been all sorts of apologies. A Holocaust museum opened, I think, just last weekend in Berlin itself. There has been little in the former Soviet Union to acknowledge the crimes of the gulags, of the starvations, of the persecutions, the murders, of the millions who died.
That's right. History books, as we said, make very little reference still. There are few museums. There's no federal museum of the Gulag or the repressions. Any sort of monuments that have been put up have largely been the result of individual subscriptions by families or, to some degree, the Orthodox Church.
Let's get another caller on the line. David is with us. He's calling from the Dulles Access Road. Those of us who live near Washington hope he's driving carefully.
Yes, I am. Thank you. And thank you very much for treating this subject in your show today.
Thank you.
I just dropped off a dear Russian friend at the airport, and who's flying to Moscow, back to Moscow after collecting a magna cum laude diploma from a Washington area university. At any rate, we debated the entire way whether the Baltic states were better off having been part of the Soviet Union. She insisted they were because they got such preferential treatment. However, I, having grown up with a friend down in Florida who's from Latvia, a family from Latvia, I recently met Mat Lar, the former prime minister of Estonia, when he came to Washington, D.C. I know that they bristle at the very notion that the Baltic states were somehow better off having been part of the Soviet Union. I wonder if there is any objective metric that could be used to settle this question for all of your listeners and for me, too.
Andrew Jack?
Well, I think it would be hard to imagine that the Baltics were frankly better off under the Soviet system. That said, if we put things back into their historical context, it's true that after the Second World War, there were still an awful lot of countries in parts of the developing world that my own country, Britain, and France and other colonial powers were still ruling over as imperialists in a way that today would be looked on as very negative. On the other hand, to turn the argument up to date, Russia, I think, quite legitimately argues that a number of its own minority Russians who live in the Baltic republics are today discriminated against. So I think we've seen an enormous about turn in the past few years.
Well, let's bring in another voice on this point. Robert Service joins us now. He's a Russian history professor at Oxford University, the author of Stalin, a biography. He's with us from the studios at Stanford University in California, where he's on sabbatical at the Hoover Institution. It's nice of you to join us today.
Good to meet you again.
What about this question? Were the Baltics better off as part of the Soviet Union?
The Baltic states were better off than the rest of the Soviet Union. So the standard of living was better there than it was elsewhere in the Soviet Union, but they'd have been much better off to have not been conquered by Stalin and the Red Army in 1945. It was a disaster for them. They were conquered in 1940, they were reconquered in 1944, and they stayed in the Soviet Union until the end, till 1991.
Just to remind listeners, they were conquered in 1940 by the Soviet Union, then taken over by the Germans, and then reconquered by the Soviet Union.
That's right, and there they stayed until they were let free after the August 1991 coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. So they've got a lot that they feel resentful about. They don't feel that they were liberated in 1944. They think that they swapped one tyranny for another, and they have a point. Mind you, it has to be borne in mind that the Lithuanians, the Latvians and the Estonians and their cultural and political elites are not being themselves totally frank about the part played by some Latvians, Lithuanians and Estonians on the German side in the Second World War. There's a lot of complex international history here that needs to be unravelled before not just Russia, but also the Baltic states have a healthy cultural existence, I think.
And just a bit further north, I assume this is a pretty awkward day of remembrance in Finland as well, which is, of course, a German ally during the Second World War.
Yes, that's also the case. This whole geopolitical space was a region of very, very complicated ideological, political, economic, and military strife in the 1930s and 1940s. One of the great tragedies of 1945 is that all the evidence suggests that the Russian people thought that the war was only worth winning if there was going to be a change in the Stalin regime, if there was going to be democracy, relaxation of the state economic controls, freedom of expression for ordinary Russians. And Stalin is recorded as saying to members of the Politburo that they had to deliver a punch at the head of those who called for democracy. That was immediately after the victory. So Stalin and his close associates wanted a restoration of the old Stalinist regime. Most Russians didn't want that, but they had no choice.
Thanks very much for the call, David.
Thank you. Thank you. I really like the comparison to Finland, too. Would the Baltic states be like Finland today if they hadn't been conquered?
That's one of the what-ifs of history. Here's another holdover from all of this era, an email question from Andrea Weaver in Brooklyn, Michigan. I'd like your guest to comment on the status of Kaliningrad, formerly Königsberg in Prussia. It's part of Russia, but not contiguous with Russia. It would seem to make more sense for this region to belong to either Lithuania or Poland. Given the recent comments of Putin, is Kaliningrad likely to cause any problems for European stability in the future? Andrew Jack.
Well, of course, it does raise problems. Kaliningrad geographically is further west than other parts of the former Soviet Union. And I have to say, I think a lot of the young people there that I've talked to are probably more Western European oriented. They're very keen to learn English. They have been able to travel across the border to Poland and to the Baltic Republics and Finland and so on, and indeed into Germany. However, it's hard to imagine that Russia will give up this key strategic port where it has a very significant naval presence, a large military presence, and indeed some trading activities to the west. But I don't think we're going to see any big tensions over there in terms of redrawing the borders. I think what is needed and what the EU has tried to focus on is really raising the level of economic and social development in, frankly, what has become a shame of very high rates of HIV infection, widespread criminality, and a number of other challenges that are perhaps more exacerbated than in other parts of Russia.
Thanks very much for that. And we're talking with Andrew Jack, the former Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times, and with historian Robert Service about the legacy of the end of the Second World War in Russia and the other former Soviet republics. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Dwayne. Dwayne's calling from Baltimore.
Yes, I'm in the Curtis Bay section of Baltimore, which is a very heavily ethnic area of Baltimore, filled with East Europeans and Slavs and Russians and Ukrainians. So I've lived with this history most of my life, even though I'm from a German background. Being a history person, yes, it's quite true about what had happened with the Finns and the Baltics. You may recall that this whole discussion was prompted by the Latvian president saying that all they had exchanged was one tyranny for another. And the same situation extended further south into Romania and Bulgaria and some of the other East European countries, which were dictatorships at the time, but were literally caught between two other larger tyrannies that basically were fighting over them. But my question pertained to VE Day. If you ever take a look at the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, which is like our Encyclopedia Britannica, of course they have a very different view of World War II or the Great Patriotic War compared to what we were taught. I would have thought 15 years from now they would have had a much better realistic education system. For example, in 1945, the Allies received the surrender of the Germans to General Eisenhower at Reims on May 7th. The following day, there was a separate ceremony that the Russians insisted be held in occupied Berlin. So for 30, 40 years, I remember them talking about two separate VE days. So which one did Bush celebrate today?
Well, Robert Service, perhaps you could help us out.
Well, you've got a point there. The Allies were divided about when the war actually ended. The whole history of the ending of the war was clouded in mystery by Stalin himself. A couple of years after the war, he stopped VE Day being a public holiday in the USSR. An extraordinary thing to do because it was the one thing that unified all Russians around him at the time. He stopped giving people the day off. He didn't want too much investigation of the war. He wanted people to get on with following him into the Cold War, following him into the self-sacrifices demanded by him for economic reconstruction after the war. So Russians haven't really been told a huge amount about their own history. In fact, they've had their history taken away from them. And the great tragedy is that history was being opened up for them by Mikhail Gorbachev and then again by Boris Yeltsin. Putin has put the kibosh on a lot of that. He's interfered with the writing of textbooks. He has offered a vision of the Soviet past that airbrushes a lot of what went on under Stalin, and he's missed a big historic opportunity today to confront the past publicly. He could have done this in a graceful manner. He could have done this by acknowledging that lots of wrongs were done to other peoples than the Russians. And in fact, of course, lots of wrongs were done to the Russians themselves. The Russians were also victims of Stalinism.
Dwayne, thanks very much for the call.
Sure.
And Andrew Jack, I'd like to thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Andrew Jack, former Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times, author of Inside Putin's Russia. He was kind enough to join us evening his time from the Financial Times offices in London, where he's now based. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our look into the legacy of Russia's involvement in the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, and we'll read from your letters. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about Russia's role in World War II and how its national myths shape the political present. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Stalin biographer and Russian history professor Robert Service, who joins us from Stanford University in California. And let's get another caller on the line, Mitch. Mitch is with us from Durham, North Carolina.
Yes, thank you for having me on. Just wanted to make a comment that I lived in Romania during Stalin's reign, and Hitler and Nazi were bad, really bad, but was nothing like the terror that came over us when Stalin was in power.
In what way?
The nation, they destroyed the nation. The nation became sick. Couldn't live anymore normal lives. They were looking over their shoulders. Brothers turned in brothers. Sisters turned in sisters under Stalin.
Well, Robert Service, Mitch's story again. This is something you hear a lot from people who lived in Eastern Europe in those days.
Yes, you do indeed. When the Soviet army occupied most of Eastern Europe, then the whole political system began to be changed. Terror was introduced, and communists took power. Romania, of course, didn't fight on the Allied side in the Second World War, but on the German side, so that the effect of German control of Romania was not as heavy as it would have been, or say it was, in Poland. So that when the end of the war came, Romania swapped sides very late on, and then earned the full wrath, the full angry treatment of Stalin and the USSR, and it was a terrible time for most Romanians. Of course, most Romanians did not want to fight on the German side, but they were pushed into it by their government before 45.
Mitch, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Robert Service, to put this in, there's been a description of one of the things that, of course, happened at the end of the Second World War was the Soviet Union emerged as one of the great superpowers, one of the two superpowers in the world. And, of course, the Cold War followed. Some people have written about Russia today as Russians feeling the loss of the Soviet Empire, the loss of all of those other republics, the way surgical patients feel the loss of a phantom limb, that this is still a living pain, that this humiliation that has followed in the years since is hard to deal with, which is why this one moment of history is the one that all of them can celebrate.
That's absolutely true. It's the one thing that unites them, victory over Nazi Germany. But, you know, the Russians aren't the only ones to lose an empire. Britain lost an empire, in fact gave it away mainly in the 50s and 60s. So did the French, so did the Dutch. There is, a problem with dealing with the aftermath of empire. The Russians were doing that to some extent successfully after the fall of the Soviet Union, under Boris Yeltsin. One of the negative aspects of Putin's rule is that talk about this has largely ceased in the public media, and Putin controls the television. He interferes in the school system. He is a force for a deterioration in the ability of Russians to face up to what essentially is their continuing imperial mentality.
Let's get one more call in. This is Vaya. Vaya's calling from Anchorage in Alaska.
Hello, Neil. Thank you so much for covering this topic. I think there's so little recognition and knowledge of what happened to the Baltics. And I just want to say my parents survived the German occupation, but not the Russian invasion. They had to flee in 1943, and obviously some of us survived. My grandparents were deported and to prison and labor camps, and my grandmother and an aunt died there. My grandfather survived 20 years of imprisonment. And my question for Professor Service is what bothers me so much these days is the trivialization of the Stalin years and the symbols of those years. I see them everywhere, from tour shops here in the U.S. in Omaha, Nebraska, to Santa Fe, New Mexico, cocktails being called the Baltics, the KGB and Lenin's image, Stalin's image, the swastika treated with trivialization, not seriously. They don't suggest horror the way they should. My father said Nazism and communism, they are both devils. But my question is, why isn't communism and Stalinism subjected to the same kind of dread and horror that symbols of Nazism are? You would not think of having the swastika as a symbol on a cocktail or, or a bar called the SS bar, and I know there is a KGB bar. So could you comment on that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There is a sort of, I don't know, what would you call it, a sort of kitsch treatment of the old Soviet Union. It was a totalitarian dictatorship. It offended principles of religion, principles of nationhood, principles of free economic enterprise, principles of cultural self-expression, and it should not be trivialized. I entirely agree with what you're saying. We must go on digging away in archives, digging away in documentary collections, and representing the Soviet past for what it was. Because if we are to avoid other versions of totalitarianism, we have to know what one of the original versions was really like. I'm absolutely on your side in this. And Stalin was one of the most evil dictators of the 20th century.
Vaya, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Robert Service, thank you for your time today. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Robert Service is a professor of Russian history at Oxford University, author of Stalin, A Biography, and he joined us today from Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, where he's on sabbatical at the Hoover Institution.